Australia's military history is more than just a collection of dates and the locations of war-ravaged battlefields. It is the stories of service and sacrifice of those who have answered the call of their country of birth or adoption and the enduring legacy they have created. Join me as we look into one of those stories. I'm your host, Ross Manuel, and welcome to I Was Only Doing My Job, Australia's Military History, a Doc Network podcast. Now let's get started. Last episode, I introduced you to Ralph Honour, born on the 17th of August 1904 as Hyacinth Ralph Honour in honour of St. Hyacinth of Poland, the patron saint of those in danger of drowning, whose feast day shares his birth. Prior to his involvement in the Second World War, he was both a lawyer and a teacher who served as part of the militia before joining as part of the original allotment of the 2nd 11th Australian Infantry Battalion as commander of C Company. After travelling to the Middle East, he served with the rest of the 2nd 11th as part of the 19th Australian Infantry Brigade, 6th Australian Division, and took part in the stunning capture of the Italian fortress position of Bardia. Now, as we continue the story of Ralph Honour, we must look to Major General Richard O'Connor, commander of 13 Corps, the renamed Western Desert Force, who had eyes on the capture of Tobruk and its deepwater port. In fact, at the time, it was the only deepwater port in eastern Libya. His reasoning was the same as Erwin Rommel's later in the year. The logistical nightmare of having to transport all supplies, including petrol, water, and ammunition, as well as reinforcements and armor, from Alexandria to the front, some 655-odd kilometers, took most of a day, as most vehicles used during the Second World War maxed out at 33.79 kilometers per hour and rarely traveled on anything that we would consider a proper road, let alone a highway. That meant a single truck containing fuel, food, ammunition, or reinforcements would take close to a full day to reach the front line from Alexandria. While the standard British lorry had the durability to make the journey, there was a critical shortage of them that even supplementing with captured Italian vehicles didn't completely resolve. The capture of the port of Tobruk would enable him to move supplies by sea directly from Alexandria, which, while it wouldn't speed things up as cargo ships of the era made the journey in little over a day, a single cargo ship had enough capacity to supply the front far more effectively than any land convoy. Much like Bardia in the previous episode, the Kingdom of Italy had fortified Tobruk and its deep water port with 128 concreted underground outposts protected by barbed wire entanglements spread along a semicircle about 48 kilometers long. In Bardia, the same shaped perimeter contained 80 outposts and was spread over 27 kilometers of ground. The ground in both areas was very similar, with flat, featureless terrain that sloped to the coast and was dotted with ravines. While Allied intelligence speculated that only 25,000 Italians defended Bardia, a number that actually reached closer to 40,000, most of those were now guests at the Allies' prisoner of war camps, which meant there was now a wealth of new intelligence to go over, which revealed that only 25,000 personnel defended Tobruk, and that 8 of Italy's 9 divisions in the theatre had already been passed on or were in POW pens behind the Allied line. 2 days following the capture of Bardia, after the 19th Brigade conducted mopping up operations, it moved in force to positions to the east of Tobruk, while the 16th Brigade took up positions to the west, with the 17th Brigade in reserve. Unfortunately, due to concerns about further offensive operations, as the positioning had exhausted what remained of stockpiles, including what had been captured from the Italians, Major General Connor ordered a halt until more supplies could be brought forward, which meant that the attack on Tobruk didn't actually happen until the 21st. Despite this, Honour and the rest of the 2nd 11th Battalion were already probing the defences of Tobruk from the 8th of January. The plan called for the now depleted 7th Armoured Division and the 6th Australian Division to attack Tobruk from the south, using the superior British artillery to suppress the Italian garrison long enough for the 16th Brigade to break through, with the 19th Brigade on hand to exploit the gains. From midnight on the 21st of January, the Monitor HMS Terror, along with 3 vessels of Captain Hector Macdonald Waller's 10th Destroyer Flotilla, bombarded the Tobruk Harbour before positions were attacked by forces from the Royal Air Force and Royal Australian Air Force, including No. 3 Squadron, though by accounts, Squadron Leader Peter St. George Bruce Turnbull was not around. All went according to plan, with the First World War vintage Italian guns no match for the superior range and efficacy of the British 25-pounder. At dawn on the 21st of January, the 2nd 3rd Battalion, although suffering 50 casualties, forced a breach in the Italian line and its sister battalions, the 2nd 1st and 2nd 2nd, managed to secure their objectives. This allowed the 19th Brigade to move through the 16th positions and advance a further 5,000 yards, and under the support of 78 guns, made their initial objectives. with the 2nd 11th capturing an escarpment overlooking Tobruk Harbour, before continuing onto secondary objectives at 2 p.m, repulsing an Italian counterattack in the process. The brigade eventually captured the aerodrome at Tobruk, with the garrison surrendering to General Horace Robertson on the 22nd. However, there was no time for Honor and the rest of the brigade to rest on their laurels, as General O'Connor decided to push on and exploit the sudden collapse of the Italian forces in North Africa by simultaneously attacking Mechelen and Derna to allow him to outflank the force protecting Benghazi. For Mechelen, sorry if that's not correct, O'Connor had dispatched the 7th Armoured Brigade. For Derna, that fell to the 19th Brigade and a squadron from the 6th Division Cavalry. According to Australian official historian Gavin Long, quote, from Tobruk, the bitumen road ran along the coastal shelf through Gazala and Timini, skirted the Gulf of Bomba, and, leaving the coast, travelled across the open plateau to Derna. West of the road, as it nears that town, the country is cut by the Wadi Derna, which reproduces on a vastly larger scale the wadis which protected each extremity of the semicircle post at Bardia and Tobruk. This ravine travels about 12 miles south and southwest from Derna, where it turns west and loses itself in the uplands. Near its mouth, it is in some places a mile wide from lip to lip, and the bank so steep that they descend 700 feet in the horizontal distance 400 yards. On the coast, for some 30 miles to the east of the wadi's mouth, the plateau ends on the escarpment of Derna, which was built on a mile-wide ledge at the mouth of the wadi. When it travelled along the narrow shore for 5 miles before winding up the escarpment again into the Jebel Akhtar. Sorry if that's not correct. On the afternoon of the 24th January 1941, the 2nd 11th Battalion, acting as the 19th Brigade's advance guard, began its movement west. By noon the following day, the battalion was halted by Brigadier Robertson and ordered to leave their transports. Robertson informed Lieutenant Colonel Lounge that the advance unit had come under light artillery and machine gun fire from the hangars of the Derna Aerodrome. Given the 6th Division's experience at Bardia and Tobruk, Robertson felt that a vigorous and speedy company assault would cause the Italian defenders to either withdraw or surrender. What O'Connor didn't know was the Italians at the aerodrome had intentionally concealed most of their forces, and unlike those at Bardia or Tobruk, these ones were not going to give up so easily. The plan called for Honor's C Company to make a frontal assault on the aerodrome and hangars, with D Company attacking on the right and A Company to the left. Honor's letters to his wife Marjorie outlined what happened. Quote, the undulating ground of the first 2 or 3 miles provided adequate protection if we needed it, but all was peaceful except for a few stray rounds of artillery fire. Then we came into the last of the cover marked by stone wall stretching away to the right, a broad plain stretched before us, seemingly as bare as a billiard table except where the road raised a few feet above the level of the plain, ran across its center from where we stood in groups of buildings to the other side of it, about 3 miles away. In front of the buildings on the right side of the road were a few aeroplanes marking the part of the plain as the Derna Aerodrome, and the first big building beyond as a hangar. Immediately behind the buildings, high ridges ran east and west from the road, looking down on their dress circle position over the houses in the stalls, at the performance of which we're just bringing up the curtain, unquote. Unfortunately, the decision to attack front-on without properly securing the flanks and surrounding ridges and buildings would cause headaches for Australians. As Honor's soldiers advanced under the confidence of sporadic Italian artillery, they saw two Italian motorcycle machine gun units roughly 800 metres away beside the road. To counter this, Honor spread his company out with 13 platoon on the right flank, 15 platoon on the left along the road, with company headquarters and 14 platoon moving up the rear. They were accompanied by a 3-inch mortar detachment supported by a truck from the Northumberland Fusiliers travelling some distance behind them. Italian motorcyclists deployed under a culvert put up only a token resistance to the company's progress before they surrendered. As Honor's men processed them, quote, we were pummeled by tracer and high explosive, and were soon coming up against a wide wall of heavy fire, unquote, from the ridges around them. The company were forced to the ground and continue their movement, except for 15 platoon, which was pinned down in an action that saw C Company sustaining its first killed in action, as a bullet pierced a soldier's helmet, killing them instantly. This slow, time-consuming, and uncomfortable approach was to last 4 hours, and Honor would write that, quote, we couldn't get low enough. The haversacks on our backs were the highest objects that moved through the horizontal hail of lead, and the contents of more than one were riddled, though their owners went unscathed. That night, they were defined, their mess tins punctured, their bully beef and biscuit minced by metal fragments, their cutlery inartistically twisted, and their ground sheets or spare socks with undesigned ventilation. My haversack was unharmed, but a broad webbing strap to which it was attached was half severed. My steel helmet was dented on one side, and something had seared a shallow furrow across the back of my right hand, unquote. Honda decided to mount an attack aimed at the centre of the Italian defences. He sent a runner across the road to order the pinned down 15th platoon to push on, while at the same time 13th platoon was to advance with covering fire. But Honda's chief concern was close support. His mortar detachment refused to offer any covering fire unless they could be given better cover. To assist them, Honda ran back to the mortar truck and offloaded 6 bombs in 2 carriers and gave the driver a message for headquarters requesting artillery, tank, and or carrier support. Returning with the mortar bombs, Honda ordered the detachment to move up and provide covering fire, and it was at this juncture that the Italian Air Force intervened in the battle to the Australians' advantage. As Honda's men inched forward, a number of planes dropped a string of bombs well forward of the company, which conveniently manufactured a wall of dust. This allowed the unit to advance at a desperate run, which saw the soldiers cover the vital 400 metres of priceless territory where the enemy could once again force them to ground. Under the cover of the mortar team, C Company rose and attacked. Lieutenant K.T. Johnson, commander of 14th platoon, quoted, "At this stage, with 15th platoon still pinned down to the rear left, Honda switched McRobbie's platoon across the road and he brought me forward to act as a firm base and provide covering fire for McRobbie's platoon to come in on an angle. At this stage, there was a shout, 'McRobbie's been hit!' So the platoon came to a grinding halt. McRobbie had been hit in the water bottle and the liquid in the darkness, they didn't know whether it was water or blood," and Honda replied with, "Well, get up and go," unquote. Despite the fact that the water wound had numbed his leg, McRobbie and his platoon rose and pressed on. It was only a temporary delay. During the final dash, an Italian truck could be heard pulling out with the last of the guns from the hangar area. C Company cleared the hangar and the surrounding buildings, but the Italians had already departed. Not long after capturing the hangar, the noticeable sound of an Italian motorcycle approached the door of the building. Lieutenant McRobbie brought the unsuspecting Italian off his motorcycle with a pick handle, and what followed caught everyone by surprise, quoted by Lieutenant Colonel Louch. The cyclist burst into a torrent of abuse in the Australian vernacular. He turned out to be a market gardener from Perth who had been visiting his relatives in Italy and had been conscripted when the war broke out. I handed him over to the intelligence people, but he'd only recently come to Derna and could give no information of any value, unquote. With the capture of the hangar, Honda deployed his platoons in a defensive position, but the company didn't have to dig in, as they found the Italian network of weapon pits more than adequate. While Honda's company had penetrated the Italian defences at Derna in that very centre, the enemy still held ground overlooking the Australian flanks. During the night, the company could hear activity of tanks moving from the harbour and repulsed half-hearted infantry attacks. Honda suspected that more than likely these were patrols to ascertain the Australian strength and dispositions. While C Company had thus occupied its positions on the 25th of January, D Company had managed, without loss, to reach its objective, the edge of the escarpment overlooking Derna and the coast. Before light on the 26th, Honda joined his forward platoon in the company of the artillery officer. It was not long before 4 tanks moved on C Company's positions and they were met with fire from 3 anti-tank rifles, 2 Vickers machine guns, and 9 Bren guns. The Italian guns in the Derna forts now began to shell Honda's positions and did not stop until answered by the distant 6th Division artillery. By 8 a.m, that fire had been subdued long enough for Honda to send a platoon off in each of his right and left flanks. The Italians withdrew. What he then called the Battle of the Drome and the Ridges was complete. Derna cost Ralph Honda his first significant casualties. On the 25th of January 1941, C Company had lost 2 killed and 21 wounded. 5 days later, at dawn on the 30th of January 1941, Lieutenant Colonel Louch received a delegation from the town, informing him that the Italians had left Derna, and they requested that he organise an end to the shelling. A patrol confirmed the enemy had indeed left and the 2nd 11th immediately occupied it. Honda wrote to his wife Marjorie, quote, "I made the Commandant's mansion my headquarters and billeted my company in its spacious apartments. Mussolini had stayed there. We had it to ourselves except that half a dozen war correspondents came in to type on the great table in the council chamber. 50 would sit down at the table with comfort and high-backed chairs were arranged around it. The occupants had fled that morning and now the typewriters clicked out the story of their going. These war correspondents amuse us. We have seen reports from Australia of Bardia, mostly in praise of the Victorians, the Quiet Brigade, who did nothing, and the New South Welshmen, the Push Brigade, who did a damn fine job and deserve all the praise they get. But apparently, no one knew we existed in Australia. However, the English and foreign correspondents followed C Company round after they heard about us at Bardia. from the tanks and the artillery and the English machine gunners who watched us and said we were bloody lunatics, unquote. However, despite his complaints about the lack of acknowledgement in the media, the performance at Derna of C Company and its commanding officer did not go unnoticed with Lieutenant Colonel Louch. In his recommendation for a military cross for honor, he wrote that, quote, during the attack on the aerodrome at Derna on the 25th of January 1941, this officer led his company with conspicuous skill and complete disregard for his personal safety. Under his leadership, the company debussed and advanced without artillery support across several miles of perfectly flat country in the face of heavy enemy machine gun fire, artillery and Breda guns firing over open sights from the hangars and the ridge behind. By securing the aerodrome that afternoon, the way was open for subsequent advance on Derna, unquote. Though for some reason, I can't find any actual recommendation in the records of this military cross. The 2nd 11th Battalion became engaged in what, according to O'Connor, was, quote, guarding warehouses, food dumps, light and power stations, waterworks, flour mills, etc., to prevent looting by the Arabs, unquote, as well as reenacting the advance on the town for newsreel cameramen. Before receiving orders for the advance on Benghazi, Honor's letter to Marjorie paints the picture, quote, Saturday, February 1st, 2 days of beautiful weather and the night so delicious that I hated leaving them to go to bed. Sunday, February 2nd, we marched 20 miles climbing the lofty scarp west of Derna and slept in the open. An issue of new boots at Derna meant a crop of blisters amongst the boys. Tuesday, February 4th, we slept on the road near Slonta. Wednesday, February 5th, we slept on the road west of Barke. Thursday, February 6th, after a night of rain, we travelled through a day of it on muddy tracks to Benina, where we slept at the aerodrome. That night we learned the enemy we were chasing had vacated Benghazi. Friday, February 7th. At first light, our battalion became a flying column. We passed Benghazi and reached Geminis to find the battle had moved on about 50 miles in the morning, and as the armoured division had almost won it, we stopped. That night we slept blanketless in the mud and rain outside Slouch. Saturday, February 8th. We travelled north past Benghazi and stopped where we are now. We are now on our third lot of billets since arriving in the area, and today I'm taking over a town guard from A Company, which has moved to an inland town. It is now February 13. Tomorrow, perhaps, I will have a long overdue wash and sit down to write to you. But first, I wanted to tell you that all is well, and he still lives and loves you who has loved you so dearly all these years. Ralph, P.S. Everyone you know is safe and sound, unquote. Gavin Long would later write, quote, the campaign was over. In 2 months, at a cost of 475 killed, 1,225 wounded, and 43 missing or prisoners, O'Connor's corps of two divisions, extravagantly described as the Army of the Nile, had advanced 500 miles and taken 130,000 prisoners, 400 tanks, and 1,290 guns. It had destroyed 10 Italian infantry divisions, the 60th, 61st, 62nd, 63rd, 64th, and the 1st, 2nd, and 4th Blackshirt, 1st and 2nd Libyan, and considerable armoured forces, unquote. On the 8th of February 1941, the 2nd 11th Battalion moved to Torca. Leave was granted to its soldiers, and a number of the deserving soldiers had quite a time. In a letter to his wife Marjorie, he reflected on his service in the North African campaign and reflected on the formidable esprit de corps and service of both his platoon commanders and his soldiers, and commented that the men wondered when were they going to actually face the Germans. They would not have long to wait, as events across the Mediterranean would bring the Australians face to face with Nazi Germany. From October 1940, Italy had been fighting a costly and largely futile war with neutral Greece, brought on by tensions between Mussolini and Hitler. Despite several offensives by Italian troops, Greece, supported by British air power and materiel, were able to halt and even reverse Italian gains. That was until the 4th of November, when Hitler decided to intervene. On the reasoning that due to the presence of British forces in and around Greece, they would present an actual threat to Romanian oil fields, which, considering the plans for the invasion of the Soviet Union were already underway, were of critical importance. On the 13th of January 1941, British, Greek, and Yugoslavian military and political officials met and discussed plans for the conduct of the war. Greece asked Britain for 9 divisions, something that couldn't be delivered due to the ongoing operations of 13 Corps in North Africa and the overall disposition of the British Army following the Dunkirk evacuation. While an initial offer of a token force was offered, it was rejected on the basis that the presence of British troops on Greek soil could have been preempted by Germany to invade and would have lacked the strength to actually resist the operation. This meeting started Winston Churchill's obsession with Greece and opening a second Salonican front, a tactic that held down German forces during the Great War and was actually where Episode 18's Sergeant Olive May Kelso King served. Churchill was unable to secure support from Turkey for an Allied Balkan front, so instead turned to the Australian and New Zealand governments, who provided most of the troops in North Africa. Understandably, the Prime Ministers of Australia and New Zealand, Sir Robert Menzies and Sir Peter Fraser, were less than thrilled with the idea of sending the Australian Imperial Force and the New Zealand Expeditionary Force once again to the Aegean, in what they'd hoped was not going to be a repeat of the debacle of the Gallipoli campaign, and expressed that concern when they travelled to London in February for a conference, as they weren't privy to the initial planning. There is something to say about foreshadowing. Both men were of a generation who were haunted with the stories of slaughter on the beaches for no gains at the urging of the then First Lord of the Admiralty, the same cigar-smoking gentleman who now occupied 10 Downing Street. Though technically, Churchill had nothing to do with the land invasion of Gallipoli and actually was exonerated for it. That decision was actually made by the First Sea Lord, Admiral John Fisher. Just before we continue, here's a word from one of our sponsors. This episode was made possible thanks to the generous support from our backers, whose donations go towards paying for distribution and streaming costs, the digitization and procurement of records, as well as everything else that goes into making a podcast. And if you enjoy what we do here at I Was Only Doing My Job and want to support the podcast directly and get some sweet rewards in the process, follow the link in the episode description or visit our website to buy the podcast a coffee, either as a one-off or as an ongoing subscription. At the lowest tiers, you'll get episodes early and ad-free, and at higher tiers, you'll get a mention in the episode and even the ability to suggest future topics. For more information, check the link in the episode description or check out www.thedocnetwork.net. And now, let's get back to the show. Despite their misgivings, both men gave their assent to redeploying their forces to Greece, and on the 2nd of March, the British launched Operation Luster. Deploying the codenamed Luster Force, comprising of the 6th and newly arrived 7th Australian Divisions, the 2nd New Zealand Division, and the British 1st Armoured Brigade to Greece. Now, the original plan called for the newly raised 9th Division to join the 7th and to leave the 6th in North Africa. However, the Australian commander, Lieutenant General Sir Thomas Blamey, insisted that the 6th was his only trained, experienced, and fully equipped division, and so it should be the first to go to Greece alongside the 7th and leave the 9th on garrison duty to train. Now, to answer the question that no one probably has as to why were the first units of the second raising of the Australian Imperial Force labelled the 6th, 7th, and 8th Divisions, the reasoning is the First World War saw Australia raising 5 divisions, and in 1921, when the 1st Australian Imperial Force was disbanded, the decision was made that the Citizens Military Force, otherwise known as the Militia, would be reorganised along the lines of the AIF to maintain the legacies of the units who fought in the Great War. Because the 1903 Defence Act prohibited established military units from being involved overseas, the first 5 divisions were reclassified as reserve divisions and tasked with home defence. This meant that the units of the second raising of the Australian Imperial Force were numbered 6, 7, 8, and 9, with another 3 divisions of the militia being numbered 10, 11, and 12. The 6th, 7th, and 9th were deployed to North Africa, while the 8th, as pointed out in the life of Matron Vivian Bullwinkle, was sent to Singapore to free up territorial soldiers for Britain. Ironically, considering that the AIF raised a 6th division during the closing stage of the Great War, it didn't actually see any action and thus didn't have a legacy to uphold. The initial force was sent from the 1st of April 1941 with a majority of the 19th Australian Infantry Brigade sailing for Greece aboard the SS Penland, arriving in Piraeus, the chief port of Athens, on the 5th of April. However, Honor and the rest of the 2nd 11th were still in Alexandria at the time and would sail with the 17th Brigade. When they arrived, they became part of the reformed Anzac Corps with the New Zealand forces. On the 6th of April, Germany attacked Greece and Yugoslavia simultaneously, which included a devastating air attack on Piraeus. The steamer Clan Fraser, loaded with TNT, exploded, causing the additional loss of 7 merchant vessels, 60 lighters and 25 cakes, and an ammunition train and barge. There was also considerable damage to the docks and adjacent buildings. The damage could have been a lot worse had it not been for the actions of Commander Warwick Seymour Bracegirdle of HMAS Perth, who, noticing that the Clan Fraser was about to explode and if it did would have destroyed the port in the process, rowed furiously across the harbour and began towing it away. When it did explode, it nearly killed Bracegirdle and another officer, but in the action, he actually gained him the Distinguished Service Order. For more information about his life and experiences, check out episode 17. The Allies lost the initiative at the very beginning and never regained it. Yugoslavia capitulated quickly, cutting the Greek supply route for its forces through the Italian front. Within a week, General Wilson's forces were in retreat. The campaign was hindered by poor communication between the Greek and British commanders, the primitive road and rail system in Greece, the difficult terrain, and the speed and success of the German advance. Lieutenant General John Coates had summed up the campaign thus, quote, "Yet, as in almost every Allied campaign in the early part of the war, the worst mistakes of the politicians and strategists were moderated by the bravery, fighting qualities, and sheer dogged determination of the troops. Greece was no exception," unquote. Honor and the 2nd 11th Battalion's involvement in the Greece campaign was a relatively minor one when they embarked to the Hellenic Front on the 10th. So most of the accounts of the unit will come from Honor himself in his letters to his wife. Quote, "All morning and part of the afternoon, troops kept arriving and embarking. On our ship, there were three times as many troops as on the ship that carried us across the equator, and there were 84 nurses. Our crossing was mostly without incident, 2 nights and 2 days of pleasant cruising. On Easter Saturday, I wrote you a long letter as we passed island after island on the approach to Greece. I left it unfinished. That afternoon, we were taken off our ship in private yachts and landed in Piraeus about half a mile away." Unquote. Honor and the rest of the Australian troops moved first by truck, then by rail, for the three-day journey towards the front, though at this point, the Allied Expeditionary Force was already in full retreat. Unfortunately, this force was already outnumbered by the two German armies who were steamrolling their way down towards the Adriatic. This was coupled by German Field Marshal Erwin Rommel launching his Africa Corps offensive, pushing through Benghazi, which forced the 9th Division to withdraw and the 7th Division to be released from Luster Force to shore up the defences at Tobruk, which led to the now famous siege, which will be covered in a future episode. This move took the already understrength force out at the knees, with as no additional forces could be sent as reinforcements. What was sent was all that could be spared, and even that couldn't be spared. Honor and the rest of the 2nd 11th were assigned to Colonel Savage's 17th Brigade from the 15th to 17th to help cover the withdrawal of the British Armored Division and the collapsed Greek army. Honor was with the last men out of Kalibaka, personally commanding the rearguard action with C Company. Quote, "By 2 a.m. on Saturday, the 19th of April, 1941, all of the 2nd 11th had withdrawn except Honor's rearguard. About 10 minutes later, he pulled his machine guns out and had them moving by 2:30. Within a further half an hour, Honor had extricated his last battle post off the riverbank, 4 men with a Bren gun and an anti-tank rifle. The rear guard climbed onto the last truck and the company moved west to Larissa along a crated road headed for the Thermopylae Line, the next defensive position," unquote. For the teacher in Honor, the historical importance of such a location would not have been lost to him. The Australians defended the inland approaches while the Kiwi brothers defended the coastal plain at the town of Lamia. During the evacuation, Colonel Lauch, commander of the 2nd 11th, was injured following a run-in with a German fighter, which necessitated Major Ray Sandover, Battalion 2AC, taking command, which put Honor in his position as his replacement. On the 20th, German forces reached the outskirts of Lamia, roughly 15 kilometers from the defensive line. As the New Zealand forces withdrew, orders came forward stating there would be no further withdrawals. The real battle for Greece was about to occur. To quote General Vasey, who'd been appointed commander of the 19th Brigade for the transit to Greece from David Horner's General Vasey's War, upon being told to hold, he replied, "Well, that's what I told my buggers. Where you bloody well are is where you'll bloody well stay, and if any bloody German gets between you and your post and the next, turn your bloody Bren gun around and shoot them up the bleep." Can't quite figure out what the last line there is. The fight to hold the Australian position started on the 21st, with Australian forces holding fast until the 22nd, when Vasey received orders that Greece was to be evacuated and the 6th Division was to be withdrawn, with the 19th Brigade holding a rear guard at Thermopylae Pass until Anzac Day Eve. If the comparisons between the 300 Spartans and the approximate 225 Australians holding the line against an overwhelmingly superior enemy force weren't there before this order was given, they definitely were there now. By the time that Honor had received the orders to withdraw, the 2nd 11th was now a hodgepodge of troops from different platoons and companies. As his battalion commander, Major Sandover, moved ahead to oversee the evacuation, in doing so, he left Honor in charge of the holding force. And it was these kinds of actions that would become instrumental in the future of Honor's career, and it was being noticed. Captain Darrell McClaskill, commander of A Company, 2nd 11th, would later write, quote, "Ralph Honor was in charge of the withdrawal on this particular night, and his thoroughness paid off then. He was meticulous, his control was good, because we had come back in section by section to not leave anybody behind. Not come back too far at once, because then you got lost. You've got to come back stage by stage. He was a very strong character who didn't fly off the handle, very well balanced," unquote. He will then go on to receive a second recommendation for the Military Cross on the 10th of June. The citation read, quote, WX15, Captain Ralph Honor, recommended for Military Cross. This officer is the best company commander I have known in this or the last war. Throughout the campaign, he has led his men on all occasions with courage, cheerfulness, calmness, and skill. He commanded the rear guard at Kalabaka through Larissa to Demokos, and later distinguished himself at Thermopylae. Unquote. As the exhausted survivors of the 19th Brigade clambered up the nets to the waiting ships on Anzac Day 1941, the Greek campaign reached its inevitable tragic end. In total, the 2nd 11th sustained 64 killed and wounded, with another 37 taken prisoner. And ironically, one of the vessels in the flotilla was called Hyacinth. In the very next episode, Honor and his men will face their toughest fight to date, as at 02:30 the following morning, the 26th of April, 1941, the 2nd 11th, along with the rest of the survivors of Greece, were sailing to Crete. And there you have it, folks. That's part two of the life, service, and legacy of Captain Ralph Honor. Next episode, we'll continue with Honor's involvement in the disastrous Crete campaign. So until next time, friends, bye. Works cited in this episode are Ralph Honor, Kokoda Hero by Peter Brune, The Good Soldier by Field Marshal Earl Wavell. I mean, the books you find in your personal library sometimes, right? The Official History of Australia's Involvement in the Second World War, The Service Record of Ralph Honor, The Unit Diaries of the 2nd 11th Australian Infantry Battalion, the 19th Australian Infantry Brigade, and the 6th Australian Division, as well as the website of the Australian War Memorial. Thanks for listening to the I Was Only Doing My Job Australia's Military History Podcast, a Doc Network production. This episode was recorded on the lands of the Gangdangara people, whose elders have passed on knowledge for thousands of years, and we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. This episode was written, researched, produced, directed, and audio engineered by me, Ross, with additional research done by Laurie Favell of My Silent Hero. If you do know someone whose story needs to be told, feel free to leave a comment on an episode or send us an email at iwasonlydoingmyjobpod@gmail.com. If you like what we do here and you want to support this podcast, the best thing you can do is share this with a friend or leave a review on your favorite podcast platform, as it really helps others find the show. And if you want to join in on the conversation, join us over on Discord. And if you want more content, including show notes, photos, transcripts, and my various adventures finding memorials dotted around Australia, head over to our website at www.thedocnetwork.net and follow the show on all our social media pages at IWODMJ. Don't worry, there are links to everything in the show notes. Join me personally for more bite-sized history over on TikTok and pretty much everywhere else at Doc Winters. All opinions expressed in this episode are solely those of the speaker and do not reflect the views or opinions of any entity, agency, or organization. It is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time. Bye.